Hello, good morning, good evening, wherever you are. Guten Abend, whatever the hell Guten Abend is in Hungarian. Graham?
I have no idea. It sounds like it's some alien language to me. It really does. Is that offensive?
No, not at all. So welcome then to Season 2, Episode 21 of Linux Voice, the most cosmopolitan and widely distributed Linux Voice podcast to be recorded ever. I'm Andrew Gregory and I'm in York.
I'm Graham Morrison.
Added this fun fact. Oh no,
there's more.
I'm Graham Morrison and I'm in Budapest.
Which one, Buda or Depeche?
I'm in the Pest side, the cheap side.
I'm Ben Everard and I'm in Bristol.
And I'm Mike Saunders and I'm in Upper Bavaria.
I hope that's not a reflection of the way this podcast is going to go, because I've got something to do tomorrow afternoon. Right, so that's all the introductions made. What do we normally do next? Oh yeah, that's right. This is the podcast that we do, and still to come, there's news, finds of the fortnight, maybe a halfway reminder that we'll probably do about 70-75% of the way through. There are some neurons to vocalise, which is very exciting, and we have the results of our Voice of the Masses, which was why do people go so utterly uncivil over arguments about systemd. If you like the sound of this, but would prefer it in PDFs or EPUBs or maybe even that crazy old paper substance, you can subscribe to our lovely magazine at shop.linuxvoice.com. Yes, and obviously money that we get from the magazine goes towards buying us microphones and things so we can keep doing this podcast. Hooray!
You can buy mugs as well on the shop now.
Oh, yeah.
You can buy mugs, but let's focus on our core competencies and our main revenue drivers, which is magazines, but you can also get mugs.
Okay, does that make it time for the news?
I believe so.
Sounds good.
Yes, right. First up, this Fortnite in the news. Mozilla has abandoned their lucrative relationship with Google. Previously, Google dropped a big sack full of gold coins off at Mozilla's headquarters in return for Google being the default search option in Firefox. This is obviously quite an odd position, really, because Google's also Firefox's main competitor with their Chrome web browser. So Mozilla have decided to... Well, according to Mozilla, they decided to change the agreement rather than Google decided.
Oh, I thought it expired, like... It was a 10-year...
It had come to the end, but obviously they could have renegotiated to the deal again. They didn't break it halfway through, but they chose not to renegotiate with Google. They've chosen to go with a consortium of competitors. So Firefox, our future versions of Firefox, will default to Yahoo, which is really Bing.
It's Bing, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. In America, Yandex in Russia, and Baidu in China. I've no idea if I pronounced those last two correctly. And part of the deal is that Yahoo will start respecting the do not track option. I don't know if just in Firefox or if in all browsers.
It's huge news, really. I mean, I saw it. I think it's been threatened for a long time. I think I spoke to Mitchell Baker of the Mozilla Foundation a few years ago, and even back then, them dealing with what Google was doing with developing Chrome was a bit of a quandary for them. I think it's been on the cards for a long time, but I don't think it can be overstated just how much money the foundation basically got from Google. It's like 90% of their revenue or something like that.
Yeah, it was. I haven't actually written down how much it was. It's something like 100 million, wasn't it?
Yeah,
it was insane amounts.
I can't imagine any other deal they do with anyone else will come anywhere close to that.
I don't know. I mean, the other thing I'm not sure of, I haven't seen specified anywhere, is if you switch to Google, will they still get a cut of the ad revenue? Because typically you do that. If you sent on to Google search, if you got it set up, they will give you a cut of any adverts they click on. A very small cut, but a cut nonetheless. Yeah. When you've got, it's about 500 million users of Firefox, so a lot of very small cuts add up to a very big amount. I mean, obviously this is a huge, huge win for Yahoo and Microsoft. Yeah. I mean, because at the moment, Yahoo's about 10% of web searches, and Firefox is, what, about 30% of browsers, depending on who you believe?
Yeah.
And I don't know what percentage of people are too lazy to change the default, but I'd imagine it's quite a lot.
There'll probably be a load of people who get automatic updates with Firefox, and then, you know, their searches will suddenly go through Yahoo and they'll get confused by the interface and complain and stuff.
Yeah, or they might just accept it and keep clicking, because, I mean, it'll work in exactly the same way. You'll type in a search, you'll get results. You'll just have a bit of different theming around the results.
Yeah, but there were some people who are not naming any people, like my parents or anything, who actually go to Google and then type in YouTube in Google to get the link to YouTube. So we'll see how that works.
Not naming any names or anything, but someone I know types Google into the search bar of their browser to get to Google to search. So to be fair to them, it'll make no difference.
It's awful, really, but searching and the kind of UI of searching has become part of my DNA, and it's really difficult. I mean, I switched to DuckDuckGo about 18 months ago, but could not get used to just the way that the results are presented, and I'm going to have the same problem with Firefox. I will probably switch straight back to Google.
I use I go through periods. I switched to DuckDuckGo, and I think I'm going to sort of use one that respects my freedoms and all that. And it works. And I actually quite like the layout of DuckDuckGo, but every once in a while I just hit something that either I don't know how to do in DuckDuckGo or it doesn't have the power to do.
Yeah.
Because I use sort of the various convoluted search queries. And then I switch back to Google, and then I never make the change back, and it just sits on the default of Google for a while. But having said that, I should switch back to DuckDuckGo. I'll do it.
Yeah, yes, I should switch back to DuckDuckGo.
Or Startpage, actually, which is sort of a privacy-respecting search that just sends everything through Google but anonymized.
Yeah, yeah, and you can do the same with DuckDuckGo.
With the G exclamation mark thing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in fact, I did have it set up to automatically switch to DuckDuckGo and precede my search with the G exclamation mark. Just because of it's just the formatting. It's just, you know, so many years with Google, which is a bad thing. But anyway, yeah.
But this is it's a 5-year deal Mozilla have made with these companies, so it'll be up to renew in 2019. I assume, depending on exactly when it starts. So we'll just have to see how it goes, I guess.
Yeah.
Next up in the news, the WhatsApp founder Jan Koum has donated $1 million. It sounds like such an evil amount of money. $1 million. But he hasn't done it for anything evil at all. He's done it for something very good. He's donated it to the FreeBSD Foundation. He's posted on Facebook his reasons for doing so, which I think, Mike, you have.
Yeah, I've got them here in my notes. He said, last week I donated $1 million to the FreeBSD Foundation, which supports the open source operating system that has helped millions of programmers pursue their passions and bring their ideas to life. I'm actually one of those people. I started using FreeBSD in the late 90s when I didn't have much money and was living in government housing. In a way, FreeBSD helped lift me out of poverty. One of the main reasons that I got a job at Yahoo is because they were using FreeBSD and it was my operating system of choice. Years later, when Brian and I set out to build WhatsApp, we used FreeBSD to keep our servers running, and we still do. So yeah, it's always good when people use open source software and then give something back. You know, we saw with the whole OpenSSL Heartbleed stuff, how, you know, loads of companies were saying, oh, this is terrible, this OpenSSL is not as reliable, and yet they'd never contribute a line of code or any money to fix it in the first place. So yeah, this guy likes FreeBSD. It obviously taught him a lot about Unix-like operating systems and helped him set up a business. So great, good thing to do. I mean, the guy's like super mega rich. It won't be much to him, but nonetheless, it's a good.
Well, how much did they sell WhatsApp for? It was billions.
It was literally an incalculable number, but yeah.
I haven't mentioned it, but I'm at the CloudStack Collaboration Conference in Budapest. That's why I'm here. And I actually met a FreeBSD contributor yesterday, Pedro Gaffini. He's actually responsible for the EXT 2, 3, and 4 stuff, as well as lots of other parts of FreeBSD. And he was so genuinely happy, you know, just at the money that FreeBSD had been recognized in this way and that someone had kind of followed through in their promise. So, you know, whatever WhatsApp sold for, just the fact that he'd remembered BSD. And as well, it's quite a personal story, the fact that, you know, he was effectively homeless and FreeBSD got him off the streets. And, you know, Pedro was just ecstatic that this had happened, because it doesn't really happen that often to FreeBSD.
I just think it'd be brilliant if the FreeBSD Foundation announced with $1 million they were going to pay developers to port system D to FreeBSD. And watch what would happen on the internet. The internet would literally explode. That would be it. That'd be the end of humanity.
Yeah. I think to a certain extent, it also legitimizes FreeBSD in a lot of people's eyes. It's it's like a statement of saying it's worth a lot to this guy, and therefore it should be worth a lot to you. So even if that doesn't mean in monetary terms and sort of attention and sort of it's something that you should try out, it's
he's not just saying, oh, here's $1 million because I like it and it's cute. He's saying this is really, really valuable software to me. And that's good for all of us, even though most of us don't spend much time with FreeBSD. It's the closest sort of operating system to Linux in a free open source Unix way. And so, yeah, it's good competition, healthy competition.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And next up in our WhatsApp news roundup, they've also they've announced, or I don't think they've announced, but it has been announced that they're integrating WhatsApp with Text Secure by Whisper Systems to provide end-to-end encryption. And the details on this are all a bit sort of light, but so far it's not rolled out across the board. It's just for one-to-one text chats on the Android client. And there's no source code, so you can't sort of verify exactly what's going on. But if you haven't heard of it, TextSecure by Whisper Systems is created by a guy called Moxie Marlin Spike, which is a fairly ridiculous name. But he is a very, very serious sort of crypto and anti-surveillance person. If you want something that sort of protects your stuff against the government, he is probably the guy you want to write it, both from a sort of an ethical standpoint and from a technical standpoint. He really knows what he's doing. So although we can't verify it without the source code and all the rest of it, it does look like it's a pretty serious end-to-end encryption rollout, which, given that it's, I don't know if it's the most popular chat program, but it's probably one of the most popular.
It's huge, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Especially with the kids in the next generation. It's what they're all using, apparently. Snapchat and WhatsApp, if you're cool.
We should make a magazine about them.
Yeah, Snapchat voice. Oh, I'm fading to black.
Yeah, we can't see you anymore on the webcam, Ben. It's getting very spooky. Our listeners might be getting scared at this point.
Is that an old woman stood behind you?
For anyone who isn't one of us four, and so who isn't looking at the Google Hangouts screen, Ben's communicating with us all on his phone. And the way he's holding it underneath his face makes it look like he's in the Blair Witch Project. It's going all dark and gloomy. We can't see. Oh no, it's a hooded figure.
I turned the light off because the light's behind me, and I thought it was sort of ended up with a glowing light behind my head, which looked a bit weird. But then,
like a halo or something. Written,
hang on, if I can position myself just right.
There we go.
Someone should take a screenshot of this for the podcast notes. Hang on, let me do that again, Ben. Ben, you should say something so that we don't get a screenshot of Mike.
I don't know what to say.
Yeah, that'll do.
You look a little bit like Ed Sheeran.
Oh, no.
I think I need to get a haircut. People keep saying that to me at the moment. It's literally happened like 4 or 5 times in the last week. And one person who genuinely thought I was Ed Sheeran.
Can we monetize this somehow?
I should have.
Yeah. Put your face on the side of a mug.
I'll wear a Linux Voice t-shirt and try and get into like Top of the Pops or something. Is it still Top of the Pops? I don't know.
But you can try.
Just turn up at the BBC. Hi, I'm Ed Sheeran. I got a note to turn up, some music thing. Just walk in. I've completely forgotten where I was on the news.
WhatsApp end-to-end encryption and some cool dude who's really cool at programming.
Moxie Marlins, he's got... his blog's quite interesting, actually, on thought crime. I forget if it's .org or .com or .something. Anyway, yes, that's probably enough WhatsApp news for this fortnight. So let's move back to Linux. Jolla or Yola, or however you wish to pronounce it, their tablet has been a success, or crowdfunding success at least. They're yet to actually make it. I don't know exactly how long it took to pass its...
it was 2 days.
It was less than that, I thought. I think it was like three hours. It just sort of... I mean, I checked it 1 minute and I thought, oh, wow, they've done really well. It's just launched. It's at 80,000. And then I think I mentioned something on our IRC channel. They went back and refreshed it and it was like at 200,000. And I was like, wow. And they were at almost 1 million when I checked just before coming on.
Wow.
And just sort of go through the details of it briefly. It's going to be running Sailfish 2, which is like their new updated operating system, which is based on Plasma, a KDE Qt thing, obviously running Linux underneath. It's got a 64-bit quad-core Intel processor with 2 gig of RAM, a 7.85-inch screen. Who uses points in inches? Should be 7 inches and however many sixteenths that is. That's the Finns for you. Don't know how to use the Imperial system properly. The only bit of the specs that might be a slight cause for concern is the battery. It was 4,300 milliamp hours. I don't know why that's never written as 4.3 amp hours, but anyway.
It's a smaller number.
Yeah, true. Units aside, it looks quite impressive, but don't expect it to last for a long, long time on battery. It should be reasonable. I've never actually got my hands on one of the Yola phones. I did meet up with someone from Yola a couple of years ago, but they didn't have one to show me. But from the videos I've seen, it looks very cool.
It does, and it respects your privacy.
Yes. One thing that is actually really cool about it is that they can run Android apps on it.
Yeah.
So even though it's quite a small OS in mobile terms, at least compared to Android and iOS, it's still got loads of apps. And even though you can't get Google Play on it, you can install stuff like the Amazon App Store if you don't want it to respect your privacy, but you do want to be able to play Candy Crush Saga. Actually, I have no idea if Candy Crush Saga plays on it.
And it was about £200 or something like that?
It started off, I think the first one was $189 and they're selling off a chunk of them at that price and then increasing it. I don't know what it's actually at now and I don't know how high it's going because they haven't announced the full range. They just keep putting in a new price every time it runs out. So if you want one, the sooner you put in your money, the quicker or the cheaper you'll get it.
That's really good. It feels like they're doing, you know, they're going to deliver what Canonical half promised with its own Ubuntu phone, you know, but set such a ridiculous target.
Yeah. If anyone don't know Yola, it's basically a load of ex-Nokia guys who left to pursue their own thing, or actually Nokia's thing that Nokia decided to stop pursuing. So they do know what they're doing. I mean, they are a pretty serious company. They've already released a phone, which everyone I've heard from who's got one has said the phone's a good device, apart from a slight issue with a battery wobbling. But apparently if you just jam a bit of paper behind the battery, it works. But if you do have a Yola phone, you just pop into our comments and let us know what you think. We'd be interested to hear. Next up, let's get back to some good old-fashioned desktop Linux, shall we? We've strayed off it. The GNOME Foundation has been locked in a trademark dispute with Groupon, who have decided to call some of their new software GNOME. The fools. There are obviously many things called GNOME. GNOME don't own the word, or the GNOME Foundation don't own the word GNOME. What they own is a trademark, and there are other companies with the trademark GNOME, but they have to be non-confusable. I forget the exact legal term, but that's the essence of it, which means it has to be in a separate area. So if you want to set up a company making small garden ornaments, then it's perfectly reasonable to use the word GNOME, although you may get confused with other companies. Groupon, however, were creating some new software and calling it GNOME, and it was obviously going to lead to confusion and trading off the GNOME Foundation's goodwill. GNOME Foundation advised it cost them $80,000. That's ridiculous, about $80,000 just to stop them stealing their trademark. That's in lawyers' fees. So they set up a crowdfunding campaign, or a campaign anyway, not a Kickstarter or anything, to try and get the money. They raised $100,000, and Groupon then backed down and said, oh, whoops.
It's all a big misunderstanding.
Yeah, it's not our fault.
I suspect like the engineers at Groupon would have probably said right from the start, don't call it GNOME, don't call it GNOME or GNOME. And then the big wigs were like, no, whatever, we'll do what we want. And then the engineers at the end. Or maybe it was just a way to get any people to learn about this thing that Groupon's making, because I hadn't heard of it before anyway.
That's true. But good news is GNOME now have an extra $100,000 to do more awesome stuff with.
Yeah.
They said at the start that if they didn't need it for the trademark, they would just put it into doing their regular stuff. So,
or maybe that's maybe somebody at Groupon was a big fan of GNOME and decided to set this off so the community would donate money so that it, yeah, that's it. I love a good old conspiracy theory.
Do you reckon we can persuade someone to launch some software product called Linux Voice?
Voice recognition software.
Yeah. That concludes our Linux-related news for the fortnight. Actually, no, it doesn't. We've got one more item. LibreOffice have released a new version and just decided they didn't really care about spreadsheets. So they've broken everything and backported the breaking of everything
To
previous versions.
To a stable series. So you're using LibreOffice 4.2.6 and your spreadsheets work. You upgrade to 4.2.7, a minor release. That's what you expect to be, just a bug fix release.
Mike is getting very passionate about this.
I am. And the way they handle spreadsheets to do with references and sorting has changed. It's sufficiently that people were going on the bug tracker and saying, my spreadsheets are broken, what's happening? Now, in my extremely tiny project in MicOS, I've always been adamant to not break things in point releases. I probably even have myself. I'd have people on my mailing list saying, oh, add this, do that. And I'm like, no, that's for a major release. You don't break things in minor releases. You either fix bugs or perhaps add a little something. But this...
Well, it's called something, isn't it? Isn't it the semantic or something like that, semantic version numbering system.
Well, when you've got major, minor, and revision,
yeah,
sort of thing.
Yeah, it's like that.
But yeah. if they'd made this change in 4.4.0 with a lot of, you know, fanfare and stuff saying this is the way we're going to do it from now on, that'd be fair enough. But you don't ever backport functionality changing things. The reason I'm passionate about it is because I advocate LibreOffice, and it's in a way it could be even more important than GNU/Linux in that. It's a good, you know, you can get people to install it on Windows and slowly migrate away from Microsoft. So this is a flagship program in the free software world. And for them to not pay one attention to Q&A is really, really depressing. And that's it.
Yeah, I agree.
Oh, Ben, shouldn't we also mention the fact that the Debian project is about to explode and everybody's resigning and...
I was about to say that's the end of our Linux news, and now for our update of systemd news. But you've ruined my whole introduction, Mike. So yes, in systemd news this fortnight, there's been a general resolution, which is kind of like a referendum of the Debian developers, and there was all sorts of things about whether or not packages should be obliged to support other init systems other than systemd. Basically, the general resolution came back and said no change is necessary. We're going to keep it the same, which is packages aren't obliged to support other init systems, but you know you really sort of should. And then, then stuff got real. Ian Jackson, who's probably the main anti-systemd agitator in Debian, he's resigned. He's saying he's too controversial a figure, and although he still believes that systemd is a mistake for Debian at this time, or at least a hard dependency on systemd is a mistake at this time, he's too controversial a figure to put this forward view best. So he's going to resign and hope that someone else is going to carry up, carry on the anti-systemd fight, but do it in a more productive way. Tollef Fogheen, who's one of the systemd maintainers, has said he's just getting too much hate. Also, one of the Debian systemd maintainers has said he's getting too much hate. He's stepping down from that role, although he's still going to continue to work on other parts of Debian. It's just not worth the hassle to work in systemd. Joey Hess and Russ Albury have said the project's getting too much about politics. They wanted to join Debian to have fun with awesome software, and now it's just arguing about votes and politics and whatnot. It's not fun anymore. They're out. So systemd is the gift that keeps on giving.
Things don't seem to be getting any better. There was a systemd thread on Slashdot yesterday or the day before, and Slashdot comments have gone really downhill anyway in recent years. But the top comment, rated +5 informative, is somebody saying systemd puts everything into PID 0 for some reason, including like DNS and networking and stuff, and everybody's cheering it on and saying, yeah, this is terrible, systemd is rubbish. Well, for starters, it's PID 1, and there are 69 different binaries. It's not everything is put into this 200 megabyte executable in PID 1. There are plenty of technical reasons technical arguments for and against systemd, but the fact is you don't see these anymore. It is entire mudflinging and just utter lies from both sides sometimes, but the anti-systemd crowd, just so many of them just end up spewing complete nonsense everywhere, and so every argument deteriorates into just a poof-throwing contest.
Well, I use systemd on my Archbox, and I've made a mistake with my configuration, and now I have to manually restart the network every time I turn my computer on. So obviously, Leonard Pottering's an idiot.
We'll put that to him when we interview him in a couple of weeks.
Yeah. I have used it relatively little, but I do use it on Arch, and well, it works fine for me, but I don't get down and dirty with it too much. Yeah, all of our servers are still on old systems, using the old init system, so.
Yeah, the guy, I like the guy who created useless-d or useless-d. He's actually gone out and said, there are some things I like about systemd, there are some things I don't, so I'm going to fork it and create what I think is something better. And he's put forward some good arguments, because there are pros and cons to systemd, obviously, like pretty much every piece of software. So, yeah, that guy's pretty cool. It's entertaining in a way when you load up Reddit or Hacker News in the morning and you see an enormous, massive debate going on about systemd that goes in every direction, and Leonard Puttering must be killed and Red Hat is evil and eating all of the distros and all this stuff. But yeah, you'd hope that it was sort of like a 4chan meme would just sort of die out after a while, and then we get down to technical matters. But like you say, it's the gift that keeps giving.
Yeah, so a quick poll amongst us. Do we think this is going to be the end of it, or at least past the peak of it on Debian now? Is it going to die down and move on? Mike's shaking his head.
I don't think so, because non-system init will still work in Debian Jesse, won't it? So presumably for the release after that, there'll be another discussion about whether it should go pure systemd. So
I think it's hard to see the anti-systemd guys seeing that they've got something to win now. I think that general resolution seemed to me that their last throw of the dice, but I could be wrong.
Could be. I mean, a lot of people could just say, right, I say I'm going to FreeBSD now, which has suddenly got $1 million.
But that's the news this fortnight.
Excellent. Epic news. Thanks, Ben. That brings us on to finds of the fortnight. When we were chatting on the Linux Voice IRC channel earlier on, a few people once again made their own suggestions, so I'm just going to flick through a few of them. In fact, HEGX64, HEGX64, how long since there's been an audio find? Too long, I say. But he provides a link to keygenmusic.org, which is a site for cool free chip tunes. He said, I've not tried it yet, but anything that has chip tunes on it is great. He also, Waring also says it's not a find, but he's been using Clang. The free BSD guy that I met yesterday, you know, could only say good things about Clang as well. It really seems to be gaining momentum. The keygenjukebox.com.
Is that like some crazy thing that uses SID chips to both play music and create new SSH keys?
I don't know. I'm not going to click on the link while we're doing the podcast. Enonym. I don't know when it's Mark. I'm not doing a very good job of this. What on earth is that? Right, so that's Night Train on GitHub. What is it? Do I just create your next OS X Windows or Linux desktop application in pure PHP, Cake PHP, Laravel, or whatever PHP framework you like?
Kill it with fire. Kill it. Oh, God. We don't need more PHP in the world.
He also links to... I did see this. I think it came up on Hacker News as well. But 68,000 Linux on a solderless breadboard, which does look pretty cool.
Yes, I saw that on Hacker News. That looks awesome.
Yeah, it really does, doesn't it? So there's a 68,000 chip, the same chip that were in Atari STs and Amiga 500s, surrounded by a web of wires, and presumably it's all running. You can run 68,000 code on it, which is very, very cool. It's got a load of LEDs on it as well.
I was surprised how few wires there are, actually.
Yeah, yes, you're absolutely right. When you look at a motherboard on an Amiga, for example, it looks horrendously complex, but that looks a lot simpler in comparison. Another find is a GitHub link to awesome awesomeness. User contributed lists of links to awesome stuff to do with programming. The Barbie Liberation Army, Beardy Man, and a thing called deconstruction.org. I think these... And then another one is modsticker.com, decals for most things. So that's just really a load of links. I will say that I've discovered a couple of things. Being here in Hungary, you know the news story from a couple of weeks ago that the Hungarian government were going to...
The internet tax.
It was a real thing. And they take it very they took it very seriously down here. And in fact, they still had thousands of people protesting on the streets of Budapest on Monday. And really, it just highlights, I think, the chasm between what some politicians think is a good idea. Somebody's whispered in their ears that, you know, the internet is a utility just like water or electricity. And this is what they think. Oh, well, then we can tax it per megabyte, which is what they were suggesting. And the other thing is that it's 20% VAT, 27% VAT here in Hungary. So, I mean, the people I've spoken to made the very real point that it was just going to cripple small businesses. Not so much the fact it would have an effect on families where kids are addicted to Netflix, but...
But, you know, if it ever comes back, we could probably create some sort of custom distro for people in Hungary. So it, like, uses Lynx as the default browser, and it's just, like, the most low bandwidth...
But it's just such a step backwards, isn't it? And it's so disappointing that people think that this kind of stuff is a good idea.
It's politicians, yeah. They just have no idea how the internet works and yet want to legislate about it as usual.
But I've often worried, you know, this is a subject that we know a little bit about. So we don't know anything about, I don't know, security or about military. And are they making equivalently stupid decisions in those subjects as well? I'm being here for, like a lot of people, I've become rather cynical about the use of the word cloud and all the IaaS stuff and all that kind of stuff. But being here, I have to say that CloudStack and the Apache Foundation, in fact, is doing a really good job of creating a sober, concise, good stack for the cloud, an open source stack that's actually run like an open source project. So it's not like OpenStack, it's not like all the big money, and it's also providing an essential function in being an open source equivalent or trying to be an open source alternative to the likes of EC2 or Google's cloud or Azure. So I think they're doing a really good job, and that's not just because I'm here and they've paid for the hotel.
What actually is CloudStack?
Well, CloudStack is the management software for booting up and controlling your cloud instances.
So how is it different to say OpenStack?
OpenStack is similar, but it's a much more tuned, specific system for really ideal for great performance. Whereas I think with OpenStack, for example, nearly everybody uses KVM as their virtualizer, whereas with CloudStack, there's much more variation, and also a lot of the users of CloudStack are also contributors to CloudStack. It's run like an open source community, whereas OpenStack, it's got huge amounts of money behind it. I mean, it did have people like Red Hat, but it did have people like Rackspace putting a lot of money behind it. CloudStack has got it was given to the Apache Foundation by Citrix when it took over cloud.com. They've spent a long time making the software properly open source. And another thing, the Apache Foundation does a very good job through its incubator programming of going through all of the source code and making sure that there's no patent liability and all that kind of stuff. So it's a bit like Linux for cloud, or whatever cloud happens to be, which has become such an essential part. And I didn't realize it was used in so many places. I mean, it's used to power Farmville.
Wow.
My other discovery was find. Last episode, remember, I dropped my Nexus 5. Well, I got the replacement screen and frame and touch panel. And my discovery, fine, is that the Nexus 5 is a remarkably modular mobile phone that I could see actually going on for a long time. It wasn't that difficult taking it apart and taking all the bits out and putting them into a new frame and screen and getting it all working. It took about 45 minutes doing it at the same time as watching a YouTube video, and it really wasn't difficult at all. Anybody with a little bit of patience could do it. And I find that remarkable, you know, especially if you look at the equivalent teardown videos for an iPhone. There was a bit of glue to contend with, but other than that, it was really easy. So my other find is that the Nexus, I could break the screen again, and while I don't want to cost myself £60, it's doable.
What tools did you need? Is it just screwdrivers?
Yeah, just screwdrivers. The professionals seem to use a very thin plastic wedgie thing. I don't know what it's called. But that is useful as well, because you have to do quite a lot of prizing and you can't do it with something metal like a knife, which would be the perfect implement. So something small and wedgy that's plastic is great for getting the battery out of the back compartment and also the back of the case off.
A plectrum.
Yeah, a plectrum. But everything, so you take off the back, the motherboard is there's a shield over the motherboard, everything, the headphone socket, the camera, the front-facing camera, the flash, the wireless bit, all of that basically just pulls out. It just falls out and fits back into the new case. It's really, really well made and really modifiable.
That's quite interesting, given Google's support of, I forget the name of it, the mobile phone that's designed to be modular.
Is yes, Aurora? That's what I thought as well. Yeah, it's almost there. You could, if your camera breaks or if you want a battery upgrade on the Nexus 5, then it's definitely a technical user friendly job. You know, if you can install a Linux distribution, you can change it. So they're my finds. And well, Budapest is a really lovely city.
I've got a couple of discoveries this fortnight. You may have noticed that a couple of days ago we put issue 1 up on the website Creative Commons for anyone to to grab and download and do whatever they want with, really. This became quite a popular story on quite a few news sites, and this directed quite a lot of traffic our way. And I just looked at the stats this morning. Over the 2 days after we put it live, it was our server spat out about 650 gigabytes of data to various people around the world, plus a load of torrents, which aren't included in that. And our server is a 2 CPU, 4 gigabit of RAM virtual server. It just can't handle that sort of load. So it's actually behind a Cloudflare, which is running as a reverse proxy, basically caching the data. And so our server actually served about 60 gigabytes, and Cloudflare's cache has served about 590 gigabytes.
Wow.
How can Cloudflare afford to do that for free?
I don't know. They supposedly, their only source of income is they offer paid subscriptions, which give you more services and whatnot. Some people have suggested that if you put too much data through them, they come to you and say, well, you've reached some unwritten rule of the free plan. You've got to upgrade. Every once in a while, it was throwing an error, like a database not connecting. And I'm not sure why you got that occasionally, because the database was never responding. Oh, did anyone else just hear some beeps?
No, nope, I didn't hear any beeps.
No.
Nope.
Oh, it's just my phone. Yeah. The other thing that the Cloudflare integration has done is, you may have noticed, subscribers, that if you've logged onto the site and sub-site in the last week or so, it's now going over a secure a HTTPS connection. And that's also managed through Cloudflare.
We should have mentioned that the EFF is going to do its whole own SSL there.
Oh, yes. I completely missed that in the news, yeah.
That is awesome. That is really good news. It's a brilliant thing for them to do.
Yeah, because getting SSL certificates, it's not wildly complex, but it's also a hassle you don't necessarily need.
And if you're going to trust anyone, then the EFF are a really good one to trust.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, and working on it together with Mozilla, another organisation that are good to trust.
Yeah, yeah.
The one thing I'm still looking into is how much extra load SSL is putting on our site. At the moment, it's a little bit too early to tell, which is why actually we haven't switched on for the main site, because I suspect it just couldn't handle it. But we're running it for the sub-site, and we'll monitor it and investigate in the future. The other thing, I didn't discover this fortnight, but I've been using it a lot recently, and I thought I'd mention it, as it's a really cool tool, is the SAR command line tool. You may not have it installed by default, but it should be in your package manager. And basically, it collects all the sort of usage information of your system, so you can go back in time and look at how much memory, how much data is going in and out of your network connections, how much CPU power is being used. So it's really handy for when you've got things like a server being hit, to see what it was that actually took the load, how it handled it, what the problems were. It's a little bit confusing to use. If you just type SAR, you'll get a spit out of the last day's data. If you do something like SAR space 10, you'll get updates to the CPU usage every 10 seconds. And there's loads of other stuff like that you can use to find out what's gone on.
Yeah. That sounds excellent. Thanks, Ben.
We should also mention that there are gift subscriptions now available on the Linux Voice shop as well. So if you want to get a subscription to somebody, digital or print, there's a special section on shop.linuxvoice.com. And the gift subscriptions come with a special postcard from, or Christmas card from the team as well. So that makes them doubly worth having.
Oh, so I'm with the fines then. The onslaught of fines. Shall I go next?
Go for it, Andrew.
Okay. I found via the news today that there are some people who are buying internet-enabled webcams, putting them in their children's bedrooms and connecting to the internet and not changing the default password, What's that all about? What, like, oh, the internet, the Russians are spying on us. Oh, no. Quick, emergency powers. And it's all just because people are just keeping the manufacturer's defaults or else changed it to password 123. Which, and so my discovery is that people are still doing this, still, in this day and age. This is, I don't know.
Yeah.
But at what point do you say... you stop blaming the people for not changing the passwords and start blaming the manufacturers.
Just It's the manufacturers. It was in our interview last, the issue that's going to be on sale, is it next week or is it
on sale today?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Tim Bray, yeah. He said that it's our responsibility, or it's the industry's responsibility to do the right thing, to get it right, to have sensible defaults. The thing with the iCloud leaked nutty pictures was, wasn't it that it let hackers attempt, you know, as many password combinations as they liked? So Apple's security policy is actually really, really lax on that. And that's what had let people, you know, gain access to these images.
I believe so, yeah.
And it's terrible. I mean, it's why you sell these things. You know that they're going to be in kids' bedrooms, in places that you want to be private, but they're inherently unprivate by design. It's utterly appalling. I'm appalled.
Don't hold back, Andrew. Tell us what you really think.
It's a good job those webcams don't have system B.
I did have another find, but I've forgotten it now.
Well, I could go then, and if you remember it, Andrew, then you could slot it in at the end. I've had a couple of finds actually emailed to me in the last few weeks, because I wasn't in the last podcast because I was in Hamburg. So Kevin Collier emailed me to say his find is NCDU. This is NCursor's disk usage. It is like K4 Deerstat, which I presume is some KD tool, or other disk usage visualizers, but for the command line, you can drill down through the tree to see which files are taking up the most space. It's very nice. It helped me to track down 4 gigabytes on my VPS the other day that was just clogging up the system. Thanks, Kevin. Hans emailed me to say, in Linux Voice 8, you discussed backups. In another tutorial, please consider mentioning Dervish, dervish.org. Although it is not very alive and kicking project, it works great. It uses rsync as its engine. Once configured, you just set it up and forget about it, leave it on your NAS. I really like the transparent snapshots. If you just want to look at a snapshot 6 months back, there's no issue, no untarring required.
They're excellent. You reminded me of an old find from the... K File Light. Do you remember that? It had this radial view of which files were taking up the most space. It was such a simple way of, you know, figuring out, oh yeah, I've left an ISO of Fedora in this folder somewhere. You know, you could delete it and free up the space.
I'll have to dig it out now that I'm using Arch Linux and every piece of software is at my fingertips. But I have one of my own finds as well. And this is Arnold C. This is an Arnold Schwarzenegger-based programming language. It's based on one line that's from his various films. So here's an example. Here's Hello World in Arnold C. Line one, it's showtime. Line two, talk to the hand, quote Hello World, end quote. Line three, you have been terminated. So it's a pretty similar sort of pseudocode-like language. There's a list of instructions on the website. Yes, Andrew?
No. Sorry, that was just noise.
Yeah, there's a list of instructions on the site, and they all link to YouTube clips of Arnie saying these one-liners. The description of the language is... although the one-liners of Arnold Schwarzenegger are fairly well known, the true semantics of his utterings have yet to be understood. This project tries to discover new meanings from the Arnold movies with the means of computer science. And of course, can anybody guess what the command is to return from a subroutine or function? I'll be back.
I'll be back.
Excellent. If you try and do something in System D, does it say, I know now why you cry?
I heard a rumor. I've no idea if this is true or not, but Arnold Schwarzenegger wasn't allowed to dub his own voice in German because he doesn't sound macho enough.
That's an interesting point. I don't recall hearing him speak German. I know when I was in Austria, he went back to Graz for a bit because there's like a museum near that city for his hometown. But yeah, I'll have to fire up some YouTube and see if I can hear him speak German.
They were really good finds.
Thanks, Graham. It means really a lot to me.
Yeah. I really like all the community stuff as well, even though it makes the section really long. It's really great to hear what other people have found as well.
Our halfway reminder is going to be great this episode at 50 minutes.
Yeah. 54 minutes, yeah.
That leads us neatly onto the halfway reminder. given that we're 50 odd minutes in, so a podcast that's supposed to last 45 minutes. Still to come, there's an interminable discussion about something over there. It's we've got Voice of the Masses to come, but before then, it's Vocalize Your Neurons, presented by Mike.
This is my favourite section of all, so let's get straight into them. Daniel Rosbach says, in recent days, I find myself short of current podcasts to listen to while I'm not writing papers. So I went to the archives of Tux Radar and listened to Linux News from 5 years ago, which is interesting since, I think because of lack of information and abundance of FUD, I only started using and being interested in Linux at the turn of the year. One thing in particular I found interesting is that in Season 1, Episode 3, Paul raved enthusiastically about GNOME as an intelligent search lens and wondered whether Ubuntu would not soon just scrap this top and bottom panel thing and just stick Docky with GNOME Do integrated in. Given that, all the rage about Unity and GNOME 3 seems a bit weird. Thanks, Daniel. Yeah, I haven't listened to the old podcast that we used to make for another website for ages.
No, neither have I. I kind of forget that we did it. I don't, obviously, because it was like 5 years, but... And still, I say discovery.
I've only ever listened to one of them.
Really?
Yeah, just before I went for an interview.
Good work. Daniel Rosbach also said... Also, thanks for producing an awesome podcast and magazine. I've recently subscribed and I'm working through the back issues. Next is the second and final neuron is from Dylan Coakley, who says, Graham mentioned an application called Redshift, which I decided to try out of curiosity. At first, I found it difficult to stop thinking my screen had become a roaring fire in my face with the orange glow. It felt weird, but I struggled on. Now it has been absolute months and I have Redshift on all my machines. I have also turned down my screen brightness considerably, and as a result, I can code on my own projects after I come home from a full day of coding at work. In the past, I had such a struggle to even turn on my PC after a day of work. The screen glare alone would make anyone want to avoid any form of screen when you get home. However, this wonderful software and brightness settings have enabled me to once again work on all my own projects, much to my delight. Thanks, Dylan, and good skills, Graham.
Yeah, I mean, it is great. I use it on all my machines, and you can get, there's an app for Android as well that will do it to your Android displays, which is good if you're reading a book on the Kindle app, for example, and it doesn't give you as much granularity control over the screen brightness.
What does it do?
It changes the white balance of your screen and the brightness as well. So, in fact, I've got it running right now. So it's like it's 20 past five and it's dark outside. So my screen has turned orangey in hue. And you can change how much it shifts over time. And also you can change it how much... You put your latitude and longitude into a configuration file so it knows what time dusk is and what time sun goes down. The idea being that the later into the night it gets, the less you want to see bright, pure white light. It's more like candlelight. And it really is a lot less jarring and a lot less contrast on your eyes. It works really well. Does that kind of explain it? It's much easier to just show it. It's difficult.
Yeah, if you put the link in the podcast comments, then
when you're using it, you get so used, you don't notice that it's got a reddish orange hue because your eyes are just more relaxed. And it's only when you look at something with a white light, like an LED or your phone screen, that you realise just how much you've adjusted, which is a good thing.
Yeah.
And that's it. Those are the neurons. If anybody else wants. To say something in the podcast, email mike@linuxvoice.com.
Lovely neurons there, and marvellously vocalised by our Mike. Thanks,
our
Mike.
Kid, yeah.
That brings us hurdling on into the next bit, which is the Voice of the Masses. Now, Voice of the Masses. This is just so... I find this so strange. The question is, why are System D debates so toxic? Only 12 comments. It's just... I mean, Mike, you sent us around that... that bit of Nazi propaganda with Leonard Pertering's face imposed on the caricature of the Jew with the great big Nazi slogan saying something like, oh, it's his fault, or whatever it is in Jew, I don't know, some foreign language. Just weird. Really, the extent and the way that it's got so personal is
unlike... Yeah, I mean, I think images like that are probably, you know, made on 4chan and stuff, but...
But it is. It does seem personal. It's not about the technical issues anymore.
Crazy, crazy.
So what we asked is, why is this so toxic? Why can we not just get along and agree to disagree like Vim and Emacs users, or KDE and GNOME, or I don't know. Why, God? Gaming on Linux. Oh, Liam Doyle. Hey, Liam. Says that anything that is run in such an open way as the Linux ecosystem is always going to have issues like this. It comes with the job. From what I've seen across the web, is mostly general users just riding the hate train, and they will never even notice it. That's true, I suppose. Many people just who don't dip into the zones of hate don't notice it. I mean, loads of people have never heard of Gamergate and System D and all these horrible troll fests. And quite happily look on, you know, use Facebook and things. Dale McGee says, it's because one particular group of people really care about having functional systems, while another group really cares about shoving broken software down the first group's throat. And ends with a quote from Bertrand Russell. The fact that an opinion has been widely held is no evidence whatever that it is not utterly absurd. Indeed, in view of the silliness of the majority of mankind, a widely spread belief is more likely to be foolish than sensible. That's quite cool. That's like the statistic about how many Americans believe in climate change. Like, it doesn't matter. It's like believing in hats or something. Burgess Meredith. With all of the controversy and anger caused by System D, I can't even imagine what will happen when System E takes over. some insight here. I think most people are just as baffled as I am. At least I hope so. Otherwise, you know, I'm riding the bafflement wave.
I don't understand why the internet has been coming so full of hate and so much personal kind of insulting going on. When, okay, there's always been angry arguments, but it's never been as personal as it's become. So firstly, I don't understand how people get so angry about something that boots up their machine. I can understand people feeling passionately one way or the other, but to the point that it gets to this amount of hate, I don't understand. And then why all this, you know, the animosity leading to people quitting, when also it's been around since like 2011, 2012. I mean, I used to joke about Pulse Audio, but it was just meant as a joke. You know, I would be horrified if Leonard, you know, thought I was bullying him for saying that.
Yeah, it's also where the direction a lot of this anger has gone as well. Like the amount of stuff that Leonard Puttering himself has received. Now, you know, if you don't like System D, fair enough, a lot of people don't like it, but he has not forced it into any distribution. Well, you know, he works for Red Hat. He might have some say there, but he's simply... He's not gone into the Arch folks and said, you're doing this. So people say, no, we must kill him, and he's ruining Linux, and he's making Puttorix, and I'm going to open BSD and stuff. It's like, well, yeah, he didn't do that. He wrote some software that a huge number of distro maintainers have chosen to use, for better or worse. But, you know, the people actually making distros have chosen to use this. If you disagree with it, if you really want the more traditional Unix way, and I can understand that in a lot of cases, then go to your distro. Get involved in your distro. Rise up there with the developers and put your voice forward. Put forward decent technical arguments, but sitting there saying, lol, Leonard should die and stuff, it's just not, doesn't help anybody.
or help maintain System V init ports of stuff.
Or go to the useless D guy write code. System D is obviously doing something for some people, which is why they're using it. So make something better.
Yeah.
What does MicOS use?
MicOS has no System D, so if anybody's really that passionate about it, they're welcome to move over. It's got no. It doesn't put things like domain name resolving into PID 1 as well, because we don't even have process IDs because we don't really have processors. So you know, it's great.
I think it's interesting that it's really kicked off in Debian, because obviously Red Hat's already gone systemd, Fedora's already gone systemd, Ubuntu's about to go systemd. They've made the decision to go systemd. Yet suddenly everyone's all up in arms over Debian, and a lot of people have said it's to do with the democratic nature of it and the way it's the way they do put it all out, and there isn't somebody to make the decision and say this is the way it shall be. A sort of benevolent dictator for life role, or however you want.
I think that's it. I think it's a lot more. It's a very political project, you know, with the whole constitution and stuff. And they've got a technical committee, but there's lots of voting going on. And also, so many distributions are dependent on it as well. So you know, when Debian makes a change, then there are hundreds of distributions that are going to adopt this change at some point anyway. Any more nuggets from our readers, Andrew?
Lots of nuggets. Frank says, in addition to any philosophical and technical issues, I think that one factor that contributes to the emotionalism is the overweening arrogance of systemd's creators. Persons do not respond well to arrogance. I'm not sure that that's all that constructive, to be honest.
Well, I mean, there have been cases in the past where Leonard's been criticised, or he was alluded to by, I think, Ted Cho, and maybe Linus Torvalds in their it might not have been Leonard, so I might be wrong on that, but I think some systemd developers were referred to as not being very pleasant to deal with when it came to getting systemd into the mainline kernel. It was about a year ago. And I think that kind of opinion had been rumbling along for quite some time. But I mean, when Andrew and I spoke to Linus, and I brought up Pulse Audio with him, and he was like, he thought Pulse Audio solved the problem. It solved the problem very elegantly. And he just thought, well, audio, Linux kernel, job done.
The thing that I find really strange about this is that as mentioned, it is free software. You can always just use something else. If enough people don't like it, there'll be a fork. It's not like Microsoft foisting a completely unusable user interface on you, or Apple polluting your music library with stuff that you don't want to hear. It is democratic. There is choice there.
And there must be a reason why. Sorry, Andrew.
No, I'd finished.
There must every single major distribution, you know, from Fedora, OpenSUSE, Arch, Ubuntu, after Debian's decision. That's not just like it's not like a small political party with only one seat.
Two seats, probably by now. An increase of 100%. The fastest growing party. Blah, blah.
And I find it odd that this is such an emotive subject when it's such a, I don't understand the technical side of systemd. I don't know how so many people can, make a judgment on it.
I think it's because it's regarded as not the traditional Unix way. It's quite a big change in it pulls a lot of things together. It streamlines and integrates things. I think part of that is actually really good, but I can understand people saying, well, yeah, this isn't the modular component plain text way we're used to working with things. And also, it's harder to switch between them. You can have Emacs and Vim on your own computer. You can have KDE and GNOME. You can, you know, they're easy to swap out. Whereas with systemd, it's very tightly integrated into a Linux distribution, and it's not something you can just change like breakfast cereals.
Yeah.
I think the Unix way thing is a sort of tool it's an argument that people bring out when it's convenient, but I don't think there's ever really been anything that's focused that heavily on the Unix way. I mean, no one goes Emacs, that's not the Unix way, let's bin it. I mean, Emacs is completely anathema to the Unix
it
way
is.
Of doing things.
Yeah.
It's one big... But, you know, no one complains about that, and loads of other parts are. Arguably, the Linux kernel itself is against the Unix way because it's a monolithic kernel. But
I was just actually Googling up, which I don't normally do in the middle of the podcast, but wanting to see who Ted Cho and Linus were talking about. And in fact, Ted has just last week, he said what he really does. He's using systemd on his laptop because now Ted Cho is a very prominent kernel developer. He's using systemd because he says in the long run he has no choice. But what he really hates about it is that unrelated projects are linking to the systemd API, you know, making it a dependency when it doesn't need to be one. And I suppose a lot of this did start to happen, didn't it, when GNOME said that it was going to start using systemd as its login management and systemd would become a dependency. And that is taking the choice away from people. So if you use GNOME, you can no longer use systemd.
Yeah, but again, if that's really important to you, then go and complain to the GNOME team. Say, why are you doing this? You know, hate launching assaults on the systemd team. Or then, you know, that's just not the way to go about it. Some software projects are considering tighter integration with systemd because they think it will make things simpler for them, easier to communicate with other parts of the system instead of dropping a file in /etc or reading a random shell script here and there. There are arguments for it. There are arguments against it as well. But complain to the right people and complain technically. Then we'd have all this sorted out much more quickly. It should also be noted that Graham and I should be interviewing Leonard Puttering in a couple of weeks in Berlin. So we will put quite a lot of these things to him, you know, like what he sees is the so-called Unix way.
I just want to put my arm around his shoulders, actually.
It's okay.
Well, it is going to be all right. David?
I thought actually the thing with...
No?
So I was just going to say, I thought the thing with GNOME was an issue with packaging. I thought there wasn't actually a hard dependency on systemd, but it was packaged by perhaps Debian, I think, with it as a dependency. But that you could install it without systemd, but I could be wrong on that.
I thought they were going to move to using systemd's login
system. Yeah, that's it. They don't want to work with ConsoleKit anymore because ConsoleKit's dead, basically, so I think. So, yeah.
Okay.
Yes. On a slightly more positive note to round things off, David Nash says, some people are just bad losers, and some who may well fit that description saw the technical committee's decisions opt for systemd over the canonical preferred alternative as a personal loss to them, and even some kind of personal slight. Their followers, rather than the individuals themselves, have adopted a policy of taking revenge in any way they can. All very silly and very childish, so much so that a 4-year-old might be embarrassed to behave in such a manner. All this said, it's extremely sad to see it precipitate the loss of excellent, well-known and rightly well-respected members of the community. I just hope that when the dust settles, some of them decide to come back to the fold. And here's the final happy line. For each of those behaving badly, there are at least thousands who respect the work being done and those doing it. So, for all the hate and idiocy, there are so many, many more people... who are just really appreciative that they can switch on their machines and, you know, get the distro that they want.
Yeah.
I usually boot my system, like most people do, with like a splash screen going across and a nice little animation. But every once in a while, for whatever reason, that doesn't come up, or I hit escape. And you see that sort of list of stuff go up with a little green OK next to it. And I think, how on earth does all that stuff manage to work? With it's loosely coupled. There's no one sat down and designed it. People have written bits, and it's all been sort of put together. How many millions of lines of code have just executed, and it's worked. And it is thanks to people like Leonard Puttering and the people who are getting lots of hate directed at them. And it's a real shame. Because it's frankly amazing that it works.
That sounds like a good place to leave it. So, yeah, thanks. Thanks for everyone. Thanks for listening. Issue 11 goes on sale today or tomorrow or yesterday. Buy mugs. Buy Christmas subscriptions. I think in the UK, at least in the UK, if you buy a print subscription before, I think, the 8th or 9th of December, you'll be able to get issue 11 in the post to you, hopefully before
Christmas. And in some parts of Western Europe as well, we'd like to be more specific, but you can't tell what's going to happen with post in lots of different countries. But our distributor is pretty adamant. Get a subscription now. You should get issue 11 before Christmas. And there's no better Christmas present, really.
Absolutely. No, there isn't. And this, it's been a fantastic week for us. We're very proud that we've done the Creative Commons release this week, which has gone down well.
I've got one more thing. Yes, cool. It's that the issue 11, the issue that's going on sale today or tomorrow, is the first issue that's going to go into Tesco, and we've paid for a 1 week trial to get onto the shelves of Tesco, but it's not happening. It's happening next week. I believe it's next Monday or next Thursday that we go on sale for 1 week only in Tesco. So if you are a Tesco shopper, buy it there, please. Otherwise, our money spent on getting in there will be worthwhile. Yes, thank you. Thanks very much.
Okay.
Yeah, and thanks to everyone for listening. And
cheers, everyone.
Thanks to you guys too. You're all awesome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.